There was a speech that you gave that went viral.
You're going to tell the Prime Minister of Israel how he should fight his war when you couldn't protect 1,000 people on Bondi Beach?
Rabbi Tshereva famously said that even talking about giving up parts of Eretz Yisrael endangers Jews all over the world. We say half mine. They say all mine. The very fact that you're talking about giving up parts of Israel to the ear of everyone else, what do they hear? It's not yours at all. Leave Gaza in 2005. We think the moment they're going to shoot a rocket, the whole world will support us going in. No, they shoot rockets and the world's against us. The more we give in, the more the world's against us. Our highest point was in 67, in world respect. Why is it that the one area we're not successful is in marketing, in PR? And the answer is because the underlying foundation is faulty. The fact that we do not stand strongly and say it's ours because God gifted it to us, that puts us at such a negative position.
Rabbi, I'm told time and again, yeah, Oli, but if you say that, people will laugh at you. It's embarrassing and no one respects that point of view.
But the answer is they don't have to believe it, but they have to believe that you believe it.
Okay, everyone, I'm really privileged to be joined by, on the other side of the world, Rabbi Nochum Shapiro, who's talking to me from Sydney, Australia. He is the rabbi of Chabad North Shore in Sydney. Rabbi, thank you so much for joining us down the line today on JTV.
Thank you for having me. It's really a privilege to be with you. And what I wanted to tell you off camera, but I'll tell you on camera just as well, is of all the more right-leaning Israel supporters, I appreciate your angle the most. I think
you've got
your head screwed on straight, and I think you have the correct perspective and positions. And I see a little bit of a danger in many of the others who are also great supporters of Israel, but their underlying principles can sometimes lead to in the wrong direction.
Oh, really? Be curious. What do you mean
well,
by that?
Eventually. Okay, so we'll get straight into this topic. So there, I would say, right now, what's most important for us in terms of Israel is our three issues. There are three issues that are fundamental. Number one is our rights to Eretz Yisrael. Why we're there.
Israel. Just translating for people, they don't know.
Our right to Israel, right? Number two is what we need to make sure to do for the continued security of the people in Israel. And number three, in what was the purpose on a secular level of what we call Zionism, what is called Zionism? What was the ultimate principle of Zionism, of secular Zionism, I'm not talking religious Zionism, and how that is actually playing out practically? So those are three central issues. The first issue, you could ask the following. The first issue, of course, is why are we in Israel? So you might have people say it's because of history, because of legalities in terms of the League of Nations, supporting the right of the Jewish people to a homeland, or you could say because of the Holocaust. These are three issues that are in the, I believe, in the Declaration of Independence. And all three of these issues can be, you could shoot a hole through them, as I've seen you do. The fundamental reason that we're in Israel is because God gifted it to the Jewish people, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, as we left Egypt, our goal was to reach the Holy Land, to reach the Promised Land, to come to Israel. That is the foundation of why we're there. Now, why is that important? You might say, well, that's maybe not so important. I'll express the question even further. We know that one of the strongest ideas in Judaism is pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh means saving life. That the protection of life is foundational to everything. So all of Torah mitzvahs could be set aside for the sake of protecting life, practically all, except for three cardinal ones. So if Shabbat is so important, you could lose your business completely, but you can't desecrate Shabbos. However, for saving life, 100% you desecrate Shabbos. And so on, you can not kosher, etc., etc. The foundations of Judaism are always set aside for saving life. How about Israel? Can you set aside the mitzvah, the idea of being in Israel for the saving of lives? And the answer is, yes, you would set it aside for saving life. So if technically making peace would mean that you have to give up parts of Israel, conceptually, not practically, I want to make sure it's clear, not practically, but conceptually, you would say, we give everything up. We give up Jerusalem even because of saving life. If this would bring absolute certain peace, then that would trump, pun non intended, the holiness of the land. If that's the case, shouldn't our focus be on the security? Why is it also important to talk about what gives us the right to be there in the first place? So the Rebbe, Lubavitcher Rebbe, famously said that even talking about giving up parts of Eretz Yisrael endangers Jews all over the world. Now, so that's why he was very much against right-wing governments who had no intention of giving anything up, just starting the conversation, just talking about it, so that, you know, to delay and were forced by the situation to talk about these things. So, like Shamir said, Yitzhak Shamir went to Madrid. And he said, yeah, he had no intention anything should come of it. He just, first, Bush the Elder, President Bush the Elder, kind of pressured him to say, okay, we'll go talk. But nothing's coming of it. We're not going to endanger ourselves by doing something. You know, he was the one who was against Camp David. And the Rebbe was very strongly against it. And for two reasons, you could say. One is because once you let the snowball roll, you're not in control of what happens. Eventually, Madrid led to Oslo. And against his will, that's what happened. But there's another point. It's not just that. When the Rebbe says that just talking about it endangers Jews all over the world. I think he even said Argentina, maybe Toronto and London, I think. Those are the locations he mentioned. I think that I'm not sure. But he certainly said it endangers Jews around the world. Why? Why? What's the connection? Just talking about peace, we're really talking about peace. Why would it make a connection? And this, I finally understood around 2000, when Ehud Barak, prime minister then, went to Camp David and tried to make a deal through Clinton with Arafat, and it was ready to give up, 96 or 98% of of Judea and Samaria for the sake of this peace. Now, I remember watching this CNN town hall of young Israelis and young Arabs. And the Israeli says, we're ready to give you 96%. You know, we're ready to give you 96%. And the Arab says, what do you mean 96%? It's ours. It's 100% ours. And what you felt in that town hall is that it was more compelling. The one who was saying, the Arab who was saying it's ours, was more compelling than the Israeli saying, we're ready to give you 98%. So this leads me to a little piece of Talmud. I made a little video on this, but I'd like to, with this longer form discussion, I'd like to kind of unpack it fully. So there's a piece of Talmud that's probably one of the more famous pieces where children learn Mishnah. They start sometimes with this Mishnah. Shnayim oisim batalas, two people are holding onto a garment. And they're coming to the court. Each one is saying that it's mine. So the law is, yachloiku, they divide it in half. You get 50%, you get 50%. What's if one says it's all mine and one says it's half mine? The law is, the one who says all mine gets 3/4, the one who says half mine gets 1/4. Why? Because the one who says half mine, he agrees that half belongs to the other. So they're only fighting over half. So you split that half in half. So all the commentators, starting from the Tosfos, ask the question, there's a concept, a principle in Jewish jurisprudence, in halacha, in Jewish law, of migui. Migui means this. Believe me in my weaker argument, because if I was a liar, I would give you a stronger argument. So believe me when I say it's half mine, because if I was a liar, I would say it's all mine. One of the answers by a commentary called the Nemuka Yosef, he says this. We don't say it if it's harder to give the stronger argument than the weaker argument. So what do you mean? Human nature is such that if it's not yours, it's easier to say it's half mine than to say it's all mine. To have the chutzpah to say it's all mine when it's not yours at all, that human people, normal people won't do. So you say it's half mine. I'm leaving him half. It's okay. So therefore, it's easier to say it's half mine than to say all mine. So now let's put it into the situation we're in. We say half mine. Ready to give it up? It's half mine. They say all mine. So to the listener, what do they hear? Ah, they must be right. They're saying all mine. You're saying half mine. The very fact that you're talking about giving up parts of Israel, means that you're saying it's half mine. If you say it's half mine, to the mind and to the ear of everyone else, what do they hear? It's not yours at all. Yeah. They're saying all mine, you're saying half mine, it's theirs, in their mind. Hence, when I come to this, we leave Gaza in 2005. We think the moment they're going to shoot a rocket, the whole world will support us going in. No, they shoot rockets and the world's against us. And it's remarkable. The more we give in, the more the world's against us. Our highest point was in 67, in world respect.
Yeah.
The more we have given, compromised, instead of the world liking us for it, they actually hate us for it.
Yeah.
Why? Because when we compromise, it says to them, it's not ours. And if it's not ours, you're thieves. And if thieves, you deserve everything coming to you. A vigilante in the world, in a court of law, might be guilty. But in a court of public opinion, they're heroes. So October 7th happened, and the war of public opinion. Well, you got to look at the context. You're thieves. Why are you thieves? Because we're saying it. The fact that we say it's half mine, we say we're thieves. Because people don't understand. And they don't, where else do you see that if it's yours, you're actually giving it away? Who doesn't? Whoever did it? Which country ever said, I know it's mine, but I'm giving away for peace? Doesn't happen. The fact that we're doing it to the ears of everyone else means it's not ours. And that's why I explain another issue. This is how I explain the one failure of the Jewish people. In every single field of human endeavor, there's no one as successful as the Jewish people. In law, in medicine, in technology, in finance, whatever field you want, in good and in bad, wherever it is, we're the most successful there is. Jewish lawyer, Jewish accountant, Jewish doctor, Jewish scientist, 22% of Nobel Prize winners. We know the drill. Why is it that the one area we're not successful is in marketing, in PR? Heck, if you go to Madison Avenue, you'll see Jews are very successful in Madison Avenue marketing.
Good point. It's a great point.
Why is it, how can it be that in everything else we're successful except for this? And the answer is because the underlying, the foundation is faulty. We could say what we like from today to tomorrow. The fact that we do not stand strongly and say it's ours because God gifted it to us, that puts us at such a negative state and a negative position that we can't get out of that hole. That's what the rabbi said.
The rabbi, I'm told time and again, yeah, Ollie, but if you say that, people will laugh at you. It's embarrassing and no one respects that point of view, blah, blah, blah. But that's what I get told.
But the answer is they don't have to believe it, but they have to believe that you believe it. They have to believe this is what we believe. They don't have to believe in the Bible. First of all, 50% of people believe in the Bible, if not more, of the world. But they don't. They have to believe that we believe it. That's why we're here. I don't have to give you your reasons for this. Is my reason. Do the Muslims come along and say, "This is, I'm going to explain to you why it's ours because of your position"? This is our position. They have to believe that we believe it. That's all they need. And we haven't tried it. We haven't tried it.
And but what if they say? What if they say that that's not? They'll say, yeah, but it's not a moral argument to the accusation that you stole. They say you stole it, and we say God gave it to
us. Ours. If God gave it to us,
right?
Now you can go into all the history that where we didn't steal it, and I think you've made some beautiful videos on that. So that's great. But the underlying principle. And it's good to go into that as well. But the foundation has to be that it's ours because God gifted it to us. Now we have another question. Okay. That's what we're there. Okay, but to save lives, maybe you should still give up land so that you have peace. Okay, that's the next issue. That's the next issue. But foundation, and we in Sydney felt it on our skin. We felt it on our skin. What's going on in Israel, as the Rebbe pointed out, affects Jews everywhere. And you could say, why? Because Jews and Israel are intertwined and interconnected and are one. Remarkable. No Russians are walking around Sydney, Australia, worried that their government is running an unpopular war. They don't have to worry about it. But a Jew does. You know why? Because to the anti-Semites, to the Islamists, etc., you don't separate Jews and Israel. They don't separate. Why not? Because the truth is, you can't separate. Jewish people and Eretz Yisrael are one and the same. We're one. It's our whole Yiddishkeit, the whole Judaism is two-thirds of Judaism could only be kept in Israel. Two-thirds. It's we focus on a day throughout. You can't separate a Jew and Judy from Israel, and the anti-Semite knows it. We have to know it. Many of us do. Most of us do. So therefore, when people are saying you're thieves in Israel, it's not just the Jew in Israel is a thief. In their mind, it's a Jew in a Sydney, Australia is a thief. Because they don't disconnect. That's the explanation to me of what the Rebbe said, that you talk about giving up parts of Israel, you're endangering Jews all over the world. Because there's no separation. And thieves are thieves. That's argument number one that's most important. Argument number two is,
in other
okay,
words, what so you're saying is it sends a message of weakness, basically.
It sends a message, not just a weakness, of your thieves. Not yours. You're not justified in being there.
Right.
Like the first Rashi in the Torah says that the nations of the world will come say, you're thieves. You're taking the land that doesn't belong to you. What do we say? What are you talking about? God created the world. He gave it to whoever he wants, and he gave us Israel. He gave us the land of Israel. That is, as I say, that's the foundation. Then what's most important today, possibly, is the next level. And the next level is, why not give up land for peace? The answer is, because here's the way to put it. The Torah is the Torah of truth and the Torah of life. The Rebbe would often say that only living in based on the guidance of Torah is best for everyone. It's best for us, and it's best for them. It's best for Jewish life. It's best for Arab lives. So, because people want to hear truth. And if we say the truth of Torah, it's going to actually affect everyone in a positive way. What is the truth of Torah? So you could say there is a technical law in the laws of Shabbos, which tells us that bottom line of this law is that if you have a position that is necessary for security, that giving this away could conceptually endanger you, you're not allowed to do so. You have to protect any strategic position you have. You cannot give away for the promise of peace. Even if the person you're having peace with is genuine. Why? Today he's genuine. We don't know what happens tomorrow. We don't know who takes over tomorrow. Especially in non-democratic countries, anyone could take over.
That's precisely what I was just saying the other day about they're talking about having like 20,000 Indonesian troops sent to Gaza. Okay, they say, well, you know, Indonesia isn't so hostile to Israel. Well, first of all, they don't have official diplomatic relations. And secondly, who knows what will be tomorrow? It's insane.
Agreed. This whole situation now is very concerning because of that perspective. And I know you've presented it, but that's the position of Torah is, it's not about today. You always have to think about the future. You know, I remember people constantly saying, well, look, we had Camp David, we had peace with Egypt. You know, October 7th would not have happened if we were still in Sinai. The smuggling of the weapons happened through the tunnels from Sinai to Gaza. It could never have happened if we had not left the Sinai.
And what do you say to those who say, well, Rabbi, you know, it's all very well that for strategic reasons we have a hard stance, but what that will do is it will lead to increasing global isolation and diplomatic isolation and economic isolation, and that too can threaten Israel's life.
I say to that, the opposite of, in practicality, we see the opposite is true. As I said, after the Six-Day War, we were on top of the world. It's the more we give in, the more pressure is placed on us. The more that you respond to pressure, the more you invite pressure. If you take a strong stance, you say, no, we're not going to endanger our security. We're not going to do that. Then I think in the long term, you will have a greater level of appreciation from the world. And we haven't tried it. The problem is we haven't tried it. Okay. We only constantly give in, and you know, how many boats does God have to send us? October 7th, before October 7th, all the rockets that came from Gaza and all the suicide bombings that came from Judea and Samaria, from the what they call the West Bank. And again, I mean, how many mistakes can we make? And then that leads us also to the third issue that I brought. The third issue is, I'll say this a little, it might be a little tongue-in-cheek, but there's no, I won't say it in that way. Let me just make it clear without putting it the way I was going to. There is no one who represented the ideals of what Israel is meant to be and the strength of Israel and the support of Israel than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And what I mean by that is this. The idea of Israel in the first instance was that the Jewish people should have a place where they're not answerable to the noblemen, to the government of the time, to the whims of those people who are treating us terribly. And we have to nebach, be a good Jew in the shtetl and listen to what our overlords are telling us to do. In Israel, we will have independence. We will have self-determination. And if in Israel, you're worrying about what America is going to say and what Europe is going to say, then you're back in the shtetl. How are you independent? Now, this concept of Jewish pride, of we do what we need to do for our security. And yeah, we have to say respectfully and nicely, and we don't have to stick it in people's faces and people's eyes. Sometimes it's smarter to do things without announcing it a million times. But we have to stand up and say, we are worried about our security. This is a no-go. We're not going to do it. And you know where you saw it? When Begin was in Camp David and Carter said, you know what, let's just talk about Jerusalem. And Begin pushed back and said, no, that's off the table. And Carter didn't bring it up again. And I was off. It was finished. So as the Rebbe, I remember then, I was there when the Rebbe would speak about it and say, they push, all America wanted is a deal. If you're an easy target to get the deal, they'll push you. If you're not, they'll push them. All they wanted is success. I got a deal done. In a sense, that's true today as well. Yeah. And so we have to start stand strong for what is going to secure our lives. That's what it's about, securing life.
And what's crazy is that this time round, we actually had Trump initially with his Gaza plan talking about relocating the Gazans, which would have been better, obviously, for Israel, better for them. It's finally bursting the bubble, the lie of the whole Palestinian national identity. And Netanyahu, I feel always cautious about making comments. I don't know all the concerns he has to take into account, but he didn't bite. Instead, he just kind of wants to see Israel withdrawing and having some kind of plan B approach, which is having other foreign troops seemingly get involved in Gaza.
It's unfortunate. Look, let's be clear. It wasn't about forcing people out. It was voluntarily they would leave. That's what Trump's plan was. And yes, look, unfortunately, I think personally, especially after here, I didn't watch the whole thing. I just watched a clip and I couldn't take it anymore. That 60-minute interview with Jared and Steve Witkoff really, really was extremely disturbing.
Just hang on for a moment. After covering Israel for years, I've realized that most of the lies boil down to one simple tactic used by Israel's enemies from the very start, the deliberate reversal of cause and effect. And our new documentary exposes exactly how this works. Have a watch of our trailer for our new film called The Great Reversal, and you can watch it in full right now by clicking the link below in the video description. For decades, one idea has shaped how much of the world understands the Israel-Palestine conflict. Israel did something wrong, and the Palestinians simply resisted. Whether it's 1948 or the recent war in Gaza, the story is the same every time. Israel provokes, Palestinians resist. Israel oppresses, Palestinians fight back. This narrative dominates campuses, the media, and much of global politics. It feels familiar, it feels intuitive, and for many people, it feels true. But what if the sequence is backwards? What if the origin point and every major chapter that followed has been told in reverse? In the wars of 1948 and 67, in the collapse of Oslo, in the suicide bombings of the Intifada, in the rockets after Israel withdrew from Gaza, in the massacre of October 7th, and the global narrative that followed. In this JTV Plus documentary, we're going to expose the great lie that has reversed cause and effect, a narrative engineered to help the real aggressors erode Israel's legitimacy. We'll trace the conflict from its origins to the present day, revealing how, at every stage, the true sequence of events was inverted, how aggression was reframed as resistance, how defense was recast as provocation, and how a conflict rooted in hatred of Jews was deliberately twisted into a story that blames the Jews. Join us as we restore the story to the order in which it actually happened and uncover the truth hidden beneath a century of lies. To watch this JTV Plus documentary and access much more premium content, click on the link in the video description.
Extremely disturbing.
What do you think Israel should be doing right now, you know, with the situation in Gaza and the whole Palestinian question? If what would be an ideal Israeli leader be doing right now?
I think if we take the three principles that I spoke about earlier, to say clearly that Israel, all of Israel that we're in control of, belongs to the Jewish people. What they said initially, we have to, there's another concept in the Talmud, Habala Hargacha, Hashkem Lahargay, one who comes to kill you, get up and do that and do so before they're able to kill you. And we know what Hamas wants. We know what the plan of the war was to eradicate Hamas
as a
military and governing body. Frankly, I know this is not popular, but the Rebbe's position would have been that Israel has to take control of the area, security control of the area. And this is something people think, oh, their heads explode on this, right? A lot of people with their heads would start exploding on this. But there's a human nature that is such that when if you're going to come to a door and you try to open the door and it's locked and there's no way you could open it, you give up, you look for something else. If they felt, here's another point. If they felt that we're not getting anywhere, they would stop. I always ask the question, is the world, who's won since 9/11, the terrorists or the Western world?
It's a good question.
Why is it even a question? Because we have allowed a narrative of let's hear your grievance. And so therefore we're allowing they say, okay, this terror thing works. Terror works. Because hey, like we argued in what happened in Australia, I argued to the Prime Minister at the time, is if you're going to say you're going to announce a Palestinian state now, you're going to announce to people that terror works. I was actually at a meeting. One of the things I'm trying to do now is talk to much more anti-Israel politicians. I was hoping that the situation today is such that if they've been shaken up, maybe they'll hear another position. And I was speaking to one such politician, and I said that to them. About the announcing of a Palestinian state after October 7th, doesn't that say that Hamas was successful? And he said, yeah. He admitted that that's the case, clearly. And then every time, I'll put it in a different angle. I won't debate someone on on the idea of if why pedophilia is bad. Why? Because the act of debating means that I have to understand the position and then come up with an argument against that position. That means to say that in my mind, there is a space where pedophilia is okay, and now I have to explain why it's not okay. So there's a room in my mind. There's no room in my mind for it to be okay. It's totally, and not just me, that's people, right? I'm not going to debate something so horrific, so terrible. I'm not even going to debate it because it's so beyond. Yet we've taken people who do acts of terror, fly planes into building, or October 7th, etc. And then we're like, let's hear, what is their grievance? You've lost the right to for us to hear your voice.
Yeah.
Once you do acts of terror, that's what the West has to say.
And Rabbi, what would you say to people that say, well, if Israel takes control of Gaza again, you end up just having another war of attrition, where there'll just be constant terror attacks and IDF soldiers, etc., etc. You know, without...
Well, yeah, I believe that's a good question, and I think there's two answers to that. Answer number one is you know, they're not always the... Not every solution, other than Mashiach, how do you know there is a solution other than that? In other words, yes, it's not a comfortable situation, but it's better than the alternative, than another October 7th and another October 7th. When Israel was in there, we didn't have rockets, right? Prior to 2005, we could have had a terror attack here and there, but there were no rockets. There were no... and the more Israel was within their communities, you had less and less terror. 100% perfect? No. Unfortunately, that's the reality. But just having a dream that one day you're going to have, it's going to be La La Land and you're going to have peace. And for that, you can endanger yourself that you could have other October 7th. So yes, it's not perfect. Maybe it's not the best solution. Well, it's the best solution we have. But it's not a perfection, but it's better than the alternative, better than endangering ourselves. That's one answer. The other answer is this, and this goes back to what I said earlier about the door that doesn't open. I remember hearing a story of one of the main leaders in the PA or in Fatah, who was in Israeli prison, and he was very despondent. He was there, he was like, he gave up, whatever. Like, he gave up completely about what they were for. And then one Pesach, he sees a guard eating a falafel with a pita. And he says to him, why are you eating? What? Isn't it your Passover? How come you're eating the falafel? And the guard says to him, ah, that's old stuff. That's not the new thing. No, that's not relevant today. And when he heard that, he says, people who have no past have no future. And he became radicalized once again within the prison, got support from other prisoners, later was released in one of these exchanges earlier, and became a major terror leader. What it says is as follows: when they have hope that the terror is going to work, they bring on terror. When they see it's not working, when they see the opposite of it working, then we never tried it. Then I believe, and this is, I think, what the Rebbe was saying throughout, they will say, hold on, it's not working. We better not do this. It's better for us to have decent lives, like the 2 million Arabs who live in Israel and beyond the Green Line.
Do you think it would be morally acceptable for Israel to, through a combination of carrot and stick, through incentives and force or pushing them to push for an emigration plan?
I don't know. The Rebbe never spoke about that. I'll tell you the truth. The Rebbe never agreed with all the Rebbe said is, if you stand with Torah values, it'll be better for us and for them. Less of them will be killed. Always, that was always his message. He never had a message of trying to get them to leave or anything like that. I don't remember anything like that. So I don't think that's what the issue is. The issue is we have to be strong and say, you're welcome to stay if you're going to stay in peace. That's it. You're welcome to stay if you're going to stay in peace.
Yeah, I think that's a really important, means test. Do you actually want peace? If you don't want peace, you certainly don't have to, you've lost your right to freedom, certainly. If you want to attack us and kill us, at the very least. So it's now been 2 months since the Bondi Beach massacre, where Islamic terrorists gunned down 15 Jews at the Hanukkah Bondi Beach party, including the Chabad rabbi Eli Schlanger, who was the organizer of the event. And in the aftermath of the massacre, there was a speech that you gave. I don't know whether this was at a vigil or something, but it went pretty viral. I just want to share with everyone what you had to say.
There are 14 Christian countries, official Christian countries in the world, including Denmark and England and Greece and Iceland and Norway. There are 50 Muslim countries, 22 Arab countries. There's one solitary Jewish state. And that you want to endanger? And you're going to tell us, you're going to tell the Prime Minister of Israel how he should fight his war when you couldn't protect 1,000 people on Bondi Beach? You're going to tell him how to protect 8 million people in the land of Israel?
So well put. And I later learned that you had written to the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, in August, warning him about recognition of a Palestinian state and how that would endanger the Jewish community. And I read that you said, I didn't even get a response, and that you cannot disconnect the Jewish people from the Jewish land. The Jewish people and the Jewish land are one. Powerful words. And I want to start off just by asking you about how are you doing? How is the community in Australia doing 2 months on?
Let's talk about that first before we go about the speech itself. The speech, by the way, was at a vigil that it was a Hanukkah event, not a Hanukkah event. We did two nights later. This was Tuesday night. So what happened was Sunday night. This was two nights later on Tuesday night. We had an event that was in the parking lot of our Chabad house. We had 1,000 people there who wow. came. Just with, a day's notice. And that was part of my talk. If you want to see this is my whole talk on our YouTube channel, Chabad North Shore. On our YouTube channel, there's the whole event, actually, which the other rabbis gave positive messages, which I was very glad that, because as I'll share soon, my talk was like 16 minutes. That was 1 minute of it. On my Instagram page, Rabbi Shapiro, you could find it if you go back to that time, where that whole 15 minutes to understand the context. I mean, also understand that I'm the president of the Rabbinical Association of Australasia, which is the roof body of the Orthodox rabbinate in Australia. As such, I wrote that letter to the Prime Minister in August. So that's that's the context. Now, in general, how are we doing? I'll tell you a little something that was is across the board. First, let me talk positively. Positively, we have seen incredible outpouring of support for the Jewish community, not only in feeling, but also in action. The next morning, Monday morning, after what happened Monday morning, there was a faith council, emergency faith council meeting in the offices of the multicultural minister. Myself and another rabbi were there, plus another 25 faith leaders, including Christian, Muslims, Hindus, etc. And when they asked me, what should our response be? I say, obviously, you have to stand with the Jewish community. But then, knowing what the Rebbe would want, knowing what Rabbi Eli would want, Rabbi Eli Schlanger was someone who, after what happened in Meron, where the stampede killed 45 Jews, he took it on himself and succeeded in getting 45 Jews to commit to putting on tefillin every single day, to buy a pair of tefillin and put it on every day. Well, buy a pair, you know, he subsidized a lot of it as well, but he made sure there would be 45 Jews instead of those to put on tefillin. That's so he would have always wanted that after such a terrible thing that's happened, that we have to add light and goodness into the world. And that has been our focus. The general rabbinate, it's been a huge focus for us to add add in goodness. On Bondi Beach, there's now like a mitzvah house. Every day from 6 a.m. in the morning, people would come to Bondi Beach. They had thousands of people putting on film daily, literally thousands. And all non-Jews coming up and telling, you know, speaking of how they support us. Even today, they're still there. Every day is 100 people putting on tefillin daily. So that's on from a Jewish perspective. From a broader perspective, the government itself has, based on what I said on Monday morning, have put out a website called One Mitzvah, the One Mitzvah campaign, under the New South Wales government, and then that's been actually co-opted also by the federal government. So they have a website with encouraging people to do a mitzvah for Bondi. We then took this another step further. After Rabbi Ullman, who was the rabbi who was Chabad of Bondi, is his Chabad house, Rabbi Eli was the practical person there, the one who made things happen. Rabbi Ullman's like the top rabbi there. And he, at the memorial at the same spot for the eighth night of Hanukkah, in front of 20,000 people, one of the things he spoke about is the value of each person of the 15 who were lost. And so I came up with a idea of matching a particular good deed, a particular mitzvah, to one of the victims. And so each, you know, particular, like Reuven Morrison was so generous to put money in a charity box on a daily basis, to bring more children into the world. And we lost this beautiful Matilda, who, by the way, we're having a remembrance for her at our shul this Shabbos, because the parents' best friend is a member of our shul, and they're coming for a lunch this week, and we're going to do something in her memory. So and so on and so forth. And then further on, and so the government is supporting it. They have our website linked to their website. So they have their website with 15 ideas, 15 suggestions, connecting it to with different victims. Then in our website, it's more detailed, it's more specific. And then we have, we've made one for primary school, for high school, because some of the mitzvahs that we originally put were not practical for children. And so, you know, there's a number of ways to get to it, onemitzvah.org.au or onemitzvah.au, rabbinate.au, all gets you to the same place. And we're asking people to just bring more light and more goodness into the world. So I'd say there's been a huge part in doing things for what's happened. That's been our response. And like people ask me, you know, a week or two afterwards, especially, how you doing? And I would respond, I'm doing. In other words, I can't process this. This is beyond being able to be processed. We're close to some of the people, Rabbi Eli, Rabbi Yaakov, Reuven. We knew them. We were close to them. Rabbi Eli was an inspiration. It was like such a committed inspirational, passionate shliach. It's just boggles the mind that he's not here. My own nephew, my great nephew, was injured. Label Lazarov, his father is my nephew. He's my great nephew. Was actually injured. My son had to go around hospitals looking for him that first night. But in a way, we've focused on positivity, and we've seen an incredible amount of atzlacha. So on Friday, the education department sent out to all the public schools that they was because school just came back a week ago, that they should focus on doing mitzvahs for Bandai. All the public schools in the state. I am, Mr. Shem, going to be giving a lecture in Parliament, in the state Parliament, on Judaism's gift to the world. I'm talking to people that one of the ways of dealing with hate is knowing. I quote Martin Luther King. I'm convinced that men hate each other because they fear each other. They fear each other because they do not know each other. So we're focusing on having people know more about Judaism. I'm giving out and encouraging the Book of Jewish Knowledge, a big, beautiful book that gives you information about history and so on. Yeah. So that book is something that I've given the Governor General. She's put it beautifully on her mantelpiece, then on her desk in Canberra, where students go through and see it. That's what she told me at the time. The Premier, and so on and so forth. So we're doing a lot of good, and actually we're seeing an incredible positive response. And I'll tell you what it reminds me of. There's a question asked, how is Yosef HaTzadik able to go through the difficult state that he was in, being a slave, being in prison, and so on? How did he do that? And the answer is, I saw a beautiful answer, and that was that even though he was sold by his brothers into slavery, and then he was put into prison, he was an Ish Matzliach. The Torah focuses and say he was an Ish Matzliach. He saw an incredible level of success. And that success told him that I'm a person of destiny. Why else would I be successful? Why did God make me so successful if there wasn't a purpose in this? So he saw a destiny in what he had to do. So yes, I don't understand the negative. I don't understand beyond me. But I do know that this is part of a plan. And the same thing the Rebbe explains, that as soon as the Jews are enslaved in Egypt, as we were suffering, so did we explode in numbers. Avram Avinu finally got one child. Yitzchak had two children. Rachel didn't have a child, finally had two children. The Jewish people in Egypt exploded from 70 to millions. So they saw a supernatural growth. And what that supernatural growth told the Jewish people, that we are a people of destiny. Yes, we're enslaved, and in bitter exile they were for 86 years. But we know that there's a goal here. There's a point. Otherwise, why would our numbers explode like this? Why would we have this miracle? And that's what we're saying here in Sydney, in Australia, that we're seeing this incredible reach and impact and effect by all these rabbis, by the Jewish community, in terms of Yiddishkeit, in terms of non-Jews plugging in and being ready to do a mitzvah, being ready to learn more and know more, some things that would take us forever to be able to achieve. So why the terrible thing happened? No idea. I can't process it. But I do know that we're people of destiny, that the world is looking to Sydney, that we have a role to play in making this world the place that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it to be, that Hashem wants it to be, that God wants it to be. And that's how we're moving forward now. Do we need help? Do we need a psychologist? Do we need to deal with 100%? And we're doing that.
Yeah. So can I ask, just now, just focusing on, you know, the challenges, one of the things I want to talk about is the backdrop to this, you know, the context that led to was basically formed the backdrop of what happened here, which was that precisely as you were campaigning against, you had an Australian government saying that it'd recognize a Palestinian state, all kinds of anti-Israel rhetoric being allowed to fester. No one can forget seeing the, you know, horrible anti-Semitic chants that were said about the Jews by the Sydney Opera House in the days after October 7th. And of course, this was an Islamic terrorist, event. So what are your thoughts on that backdrop, on all those problems and people not really connecting the dots on how, you know, anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism is all part of the same thing? Do you sense that there's a shift right now among Australians, Australian institutions, the people themselves? Or are you concerned that, you know, there was a moment of concern but ultimately people are falling back asleep again?
As I said, I've made it a goal of mine to reach out to many of the politicians to speak again, to try to give them the perspective and understanding that you cannot divorce the two. As I said in my speech two nights late, you know, on that Tuesday night, that, saying globalized intifada Sunday night, the massacre in Bondi was globalized intifada in action. There's a concept that perception takes time to change. And it means to argue again and again, you need to hear it again. When you have a certain perception on the world, certain perspective where you come from, where you're educated in, university perspective that you gain, I can't just come and give you a good argument and change you like that.
Yeah.
Now, a massacre like what happened is going to shake people up and allow some crack to form, to maybe, hopefully, because I do believe that a lot of these people are not essentially anti-Semitic. I don't think the prime minister is an anti-Semite. I just think he made mistakes in policy, not imagining that this would happen.
I also think there's just a lot of lack of clarity about the essential nature of Palestinian nationalism. You know, just people are, and we're not maybe being clear enough with people.
So they made mistakes, but I don't think that they're anti-Semites. Okay, so therefore, if you say they're anti-Semite, what's it to talk to?
For sure.
But they're not.
Sure. Yeah.
So they just have a worldview, which they grew up with as a university student. He was such. And to change your whole worldview in one moment is not a simple or easy thing at all. Mm-hmm. So we have to talk from this angle, from that angle, from the other. And if Israel would take on the positions, not to say that, you know, we're thieves, so to speak, it would make life easier. That's regards to that. But going back to what we need to do is continue to talk, to continue to gauge. I tell you an example. We have a local representative in federal parliament who I got a call from her PA, and this is it's just last week. I think it was last week, a week and a half ago. It was actually now 2 weeks ago. Plus 2 weeks ago, saying that if she's asked about the president of Israel was just here to visit, she's going to say it's not a good time. At least she gave me that call, and I spoke to them that that's not a good idea, and that would rip the wounds. You know, here he's coming to give comfort. He represents Israel. He's coming here as a representative of the Jewish state, to give comfort to the Jewish people who live here. For you to say that, so when is a good time? Basically, and you're giving in to those who are throwing a tantrum. Is that how you're meant to behave? And And I said, you're crossing a red line. You're really going to hurt us. I let my fellow rabbis of our area know. They sent some beautiful letters. I'm saying strong letters to her. And thank God she didn't say that. She didn't. She was shtum. She was quiet. She didn't. She wasn't one of the voices against the president's visit. She didn't support it, but she wasn't against it. At least she didn't come out against it. So that was a minor win, shall I say, in that. And that's what it's going to take. We continue to talk, to continue to give the arguments that how could you support a terrorist organization over a liberal democracy? Liberal democracy is a fellow liberal democracy. The system is part of the end goal. They have in my view, a far left court system that's going to keep them in check. They don't need you to keep them in check.
Yeah. Well, I think for them, it all comes back to this point of that, you know, they're being persuaded that somehow this land has been stolen. And so, what liberal democracy or not, and that's why it goes back to what we were discussing earlier and off camera as well, which I know we'll touch on more about the whole issue of who really owns it and what the best argument is. Rabbi, unfortunately, we're out of time, but just I'd like to just finish by just asking you for just in the last minute or two, what is your message to people watching? We have a very wide variety of viewers, Jews, non-Jews, observant, not practicing, from all different ends of the political spectrum. What would be your message to people?
Look, the first and foremost important message is what I was saying just lately, and that is we, as Jews, we know that regardless of what happens, we need to add light. And when we have terrible things that happen to us, we can't fathom it. We don't understand it. We know we don't understand the ways of God, and I'm not going to try to. But what we need to focus us on is what are we going to do to make this world a better place? That has to be. So for Jewish people, they should be doing Jewish mitzvahs. For the whole world, they should do mitzvahs in terms of good deeds. To make this, there's an important point in that terrorists, this is a very important short point. Terrorists are living for a higher purpose, a demonic higher purpose, but in their mind, a higher purpose. The predominance of their religion is seen as such a purpose that they're ready to give their life for it. How is the West able to counterbalance that? What's the higher purpose? Making money? You know, having a nice barbecue, going lying on the beach? Is that what the higher purpose is? That's going to be something that could counterbalance the negativity? We also have to live for a higher purpose, a purpose higher than ourselves. We have to live for helping others, for being there for others, for giving, for making the world a better place. That's what we have to teach our children. That's what we have to do ourselves. We have to live for a higher purpose. That's the only counterbalance to their demonic higher purpose. That's just focusing on self and self-interest and thinking mistakenly, oh, if they had better opportunities, if they had better education, if they had more money, then they wouldn't be terrorists. No way, because that's not a higher purpose in their mind. What they're living for now in their mind is a higher purpose, and that's what's causing them to do what they're doing. We need to live for that higher purpose. That's the first and foremost, most important message I would have. And to be proud, to walk with pride, to walk with pride as Jews, that we have nothing to be ashamed of, we have nothing to be scared of. We have to put our faith and our hope in Hashem. And, you know, when we do, then we know we're living for the purpose Hashem wants us to live for. And I think that's the most important message. Together with that, we also have to know, we stand, yes, that Israel belongs to the Jewish people, and we're not going to, because God gifted it to us, all the other things as well, but that's on the foundation of it being given to us. But we have to believe it. That's all. They have to know we believe it.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's the two issues I would point out. There are other things I could tell you, but I guess we're out of time.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in there, Rabbi, and this has been such an eye-opening and insightful interview. I know that our viewers are going to really appreciate your insights and in-depth wisdom, fusing Torah, morality, political commentary. It's greatly, greatly appreciated. Great to speak to someone literally across the other side of the world. Absolutely love technology. Literally a few decades early, just being able to have this kind of channel and do this would not be possible. So it's pretty awesome. And it's so great that I think we connected originally just because I spoke about your video and you ended up reaching out. So just super grateful to you for what you're doing and wishing you much hatzlacha rabba with all the essential work that you're doing for the Australian Jewish community and beyond. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And I thank you for what you're doing. As I started the show, I think you're ahead of all the other supporters of Israel in your moral clarity and your strong position in your, well, even the way you present things, but certainly in your foundation. I therefore felt that, it'd be great to be with you. And I want to give you chizuk to continue what you're doing.
Thank you so much.
I think it's extremely vital.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. That means a lot. Thank you so much. Just quickly, we've all heard of heaven, hell, and the afterlife. And at some point, I'm sure you've given it some thought. But the Jewish view is radically different from almost everything you've been taught. And once you hear it, it will change how you understand life itself. Have a watch of the trailer for our new JTV Plus documentary called Heaven, Hell, and the Afterlife. And you can watch the full film right now by clicking the link below in the video description. Across the world, the afterlife is described in simple terms. Heaven above, hell below, the devil waiting to tempt you, and a humanity born in original sin. But Judaism tells a story that is older, deeper, and far more hopeful. Less obsessed with fear and more rooted in purpose. A story where the soul is not born guilty, but born noble. Where the body is not the enemy, but the partner. Where the devil isn't God's rival, but his assistant, because Judaism has no second power. Where hell exists, but not forever. Where heaven exists, but not as the final destination. And where the real end of the human story is resurrection, not escape. Judaism views history as a mission, not a mistake. Other civilizations teach that we are here to earn our way into heaven. Judaism teaches that we are here to bring heaven down to earth. And to understand what happens after we die, we first have to understand why we're here in the first place. In this JTV Plus documentary, we're going to reveal the Jewish vision of life after death. One of the most misunderstood ideas, but if understood correctly, can transform your very understanding of life itself. To watch this JTV Plus documentary and access much more premium content, click on the link in the video description.